Okay, the first thing I'd like to do is start by just welcoming you all here today. It's really, really fantastic to see so many people interested in classics. Now, as you know, at Oxford, there's a lot of different things that you can study under the classics umbrella. And one of these things is archaeology. Now, I'm a Roman archaeologist, so that's what I'm going to talk to you about today, Roman archaeology. The main thing that I'm interested in is understanding ancient images and what these can tell us about the lives of people in the ancient world. We're still doing sound checks for that, but what these things tell us about the lives of people in the ancient world. Now, it sounds like a really macabre subject. You think faces of the dead, how kind of dark, but this is actually not at all the case. We judge people every day now on how they look. We can tell things like occupation, so up here where there's a doctor, a nurse, a surgeon, we tell things like different forms of cultural allegiance, from religious views to music preferences. Even when someone isn't particularly bothered about how they look, they tend to dress to meet the minimum requirement. So businessmen like these guys here can't turn up to a business meeting dressed as a clown or in a cocktail dress. Now, the way these people look, we read it, we understand it, because it's our culture. What I want to do today is to look at understanding images from the Roman world in the same way as we understand this kind of body language, this kind of fashion, this kind of style, the sort of statements people are making about themselves through these costumes. Now, all of these portraits were put up so that an individual could be remembered by their family. Memory is a particularly Roman concern. It could be achieved by the famous through writing books or through public statues. But for most people, funerary portraiture was the main way of shaping how people would perceive them after they died. Just like how we dress now, these portraits are defined by cultural preferences, so that the dead are remembered in a positive way. This might mean making images in a different range of materials. So up here, I hope you can see the picture right, but here we've got images in local stone. There they are, carved out in marble. This one, a great gilded bronze statue. Over here, they've gone for a cheaper option and carved it out of stucco or plaster. All different materials, modelled into different forms to reflect cultural preferences. So here we've got a person in a toga. Here we've got images representing the deceased as deities. Both are quite popular in the Roman world. Now, to produce different forms, togaic statues, these all reflect the different cultural values and concerns of living people, just like our dress styles do today. With an image, you've actually got greater freedom, though, so that unlike with the human body, we're restricted by what we can wear, how we can fashion it, whether we tattoo it, how we do our hair. With a statue, you can make yourself 10 feet tall. You can dress yourself as a deity. You can gild yourself. So you've actually got greater freedom in achieving a kind of representation of yourself. It's an exaggeration of you, a way of representing a sort of super you, best possible version of yourself, so that in representations after you've died, people will see images of you and think of you in the light that you consider the most positive. Now, the styles that they chose tell us something about this society. So values of Roman citizenship are shown to the toga. This is a really common preference, so lots of people are represented toga. They've chosen to do this because it says something about civilian values. It shouts the fact, I've made it, I'm a Roman citizen. And at this point in this world, that's top of the tree, you've made it. Other people, like this lady here, is absolutely enswathed in cloth. You can't actually see very much of her body because it's completely covered in the fabric of her dress. This is saying something about the gendered values. So women in this society, you cover yourself, you drape yourself to make yourself a bit more modest. This is very kind of a way of being an appropriate Roman matron. These images at the end here, to me, are more interesting because in the Roman world, a woman can't walk down the street dressed like that. I mean, it's simply like now, it's not appropriate, it's not acceptable. Now, this tells us something about the way people can be represented in death. So it's perfectly acceptable to show her half-naked like this. This is because she's made here as the form of a famous statue. Her bottom half here is like a classical statue of Venus, while the top half, she's got these very stern, Roman matronly features. She looks quite old, there's indications of age in her face there, and they've married the two together. Now, this is because they're actually making a statement saying, not this woman is Venus, it's saying she's like Venus, she's as beautiful as Venus. This is very, very selective. I mean, all of you know here, Venus isn't just a goddess of beauty, she's a goddess of sexual love. They're not making that kind of statement about this woman, and they're making that quite clear by giving her these stern, Roman, matronly values. What they're saying is that she's beautiful. The same thing is going on up here. This man's represented as Mercury. You can tell that by he's got the attributes of Mercury there and a little purse in his hand, because Mercury is the god of trade. So by saying this, they're saying he's a kind of super businessman. He's better than a normal businessman. He's really, really top of the tree in terms of business. Now, these portraits aren't just tucked away in quiet cemeteries. Actually, some are seen by thousands of people every day. They're more like public statues, almost like our equivalent of being on television, I guess. If we have a look at the context these images are used in, we kind of come to understand them better. Now, in the Roman period, there's such an interest in making people and their families memorable and present in the lives of the living that it resulted in necropoli, which literally means cities of the dead, growing outside towns like Rome. So that here,
this is the Via Appia going into Rome,
and here you've actually got 8 miles of tombs lining the streets as you come in.
Outside Pompeii, you see the same thing.
Not 8 miles, because it's a much smaller settlement.
But again, tombs actually lining the streets. And here, this is the port town of Ostia's necropolis, which again surrounded it. All of them covered in statues and in inscriptions.
Now, many of these tombs' inscriptions state their names, age of death, and professions. A number of them actually addressed passers-by, kind of shouting, "Oi, stop, look at me, remember me, think about my statue, think about my my identity, remember me." That's what they're literally screaming out. They do it through different types of tombs, so these are made to look a bit like houses. On the Via Appia in Rome, we have some that are as large as temples actually put up there so that you remember the dead. And this one here is completely unique. It's used to evoke this person's service in Egypt. He'd actually served as a procurator in that province. And so he built this tomb in the form of a pyramid to absolutely literally go, "Stop, remember me." It's a huge act of self-publicity. And on the outside here, again, were statues. Now, people bothered to spend money on the tombs because it helped to create a name in history for them forever. And also because they came to visit the dead on a pretty regular basis. In the Roman calendar, one had to stop and see dead relatives on the birthday of the dead person, on the anniversary of their death, and on numerous other special days of the dead throughout the year. Each tomb contained a lot of people, so even if you're only coming out to visit them on the day of the dead, say, for their birthday and anniversary, this tomb here contained 30 people. You're already coming out there 60 days of the year. They're not just tucked away, these are vital parts of Roman society. And everyone in society, from emperors and the elite to butchers and bakers, all of these people invest in tombs. Now, even ex-slaves could own tombs, and many spent a lot of money on them. Some would join burial clubs so that they could manage the cost by paying a regular contribution each month. There are a number of burial clubs actually recorded in these inscriptions in this tomb. And if you've done particularly well, if you've done great service for your burial club, you were voted a portrait like these. Now, these portraits are
absolutely top of the range. You can see them here.
They're marble, there's nothing low quality about them. Bearing in mind these people had lived their lives as slaves and have then been represented in images which, if they came from anywhere else, we'd think they belonged to Roman aristocrats. This is telling us something about these people, ex-slaves, and how kind of role they can encompass in society. It's showing us a glimpse of their culture, which is striking and really rather unexpected. Now, in portrait reliefs like this one up at the top, we see ex-slaves again represented in the sorts of relationships that people valued. Here we have two ex-slaves that married each other. You can see that by the hand holding gesture. Now, they must have been proud of this, not only because they loved each other, but also because slaves aren't allowed to marry. It's not legal. So the fact that you can be shown married is making a statement of saying, "I'm free." It's saying, "I've made it. I've achieved my form of Roman citizenship."
So it's got a certain amount of social status about it as well.
Now, the chap at the top here, those of you, if anybody's ever visited Rome, this is a tomb that you actually see on the way in on the train. It looks like a piece of fascist architecture, but it's not. The reason why it looks like this with these weird holes in there is because they've actually incorporated elements of a bread kneading machine on the actual tomb. And this is because this guy was a baker. So he's made his tomb actually out of bits of the bakery and then put them up there so that people, when they see it, remember his profession. He's underlined this by all the way around the top of the tomb, putting on images of bread baking. Now, on the other face of the tomb, here, goes the image of him in this toga, very respectable looking, looking again almost like a Roman senator with his wife. But underneath, he goes, "This is myself and my wife," again, very respectable, very kind of properly dressed. She's bearing a bread basket. So again, underlining this element of his professional life. Now, if we only had people like Cicero talking about attitudes to profession, we would have absolutely no idea that the idea of kind of Roman senatorial citizenship could go alongside trade. Cicero is very sniffy and sneery about kind of attitudes towards so-called manual work and earning your money. Yet here we see this man sees absolutely no contradiction at all in putting the two together. He's very proud of his profession and he's proud of the fact that he's made it as a citizen. Now, we wouldn't know anything about these people without these monuments. They aren't the famous great men of history, yet we still get to know how they wanted to be remembered in these kind of warts and all faces, showing us all the signs of age and everything about them that they want to have represented. Often the images of ex-slaves and members of the elite could be remarkably similar, down to the fact they might choose to follow the same fashions. So here, this is Livia, the wife of Augustus, and this is a lady called Antistia. She actually was a slave who was then freed and went on to marry her master, who's represented there. Now, they're from totally different social echelons, but you still see here, you see this kind of quiff style stuck on top of her head? That's exactly the same as Livia is wearing there. And this is showing us something about the broad participation in elite culture. It's actually, as soon as Livia dresses like this, people start to copy her. Now, the only kind of parallels I can think of in our own society are people like David Beckham. I don't know if you can remember him. But when he shaved his head, a lot of other people copied him. The same thing with, you're probably too young to remember, but Jennifer Aniston from Friends. When she cut her hair in that kind of sloping down kind of fashion, lots of people copied her again. So this is telling us something about how the imperial family were perceived by normal people. They're really the trendsetters in this society. Now, these are some of the changes that you see in fashion in the imperial court. So we've got Augustus on the end there, going right the way through here to a mid-third century emperor that most people haven't actually heard of, but there he is in all his glory. Now, this actually mirrors things that we should be familiar with. If you think about people, how they're dressing in the 1920s, 1930s, if you think of the flapper women going through to, say, in the 60s, when people are dressing like hippies, or the 70s, going through to the 80s, where people are power dressing, the 90s grunge, this is telling us something about their society, about how they want to be seen. And these images don't just stay in Rome, they're sent out to the provinces so that people know what their emperor looks like. Otherwise they've got no conception of who their ruler actually is. So when the images, like this one or this one, are sent out to sort of darkest, wherever it is, that's how they actually know what's going on in Rome, and that affects the way that people in the provinces want to be seen and the fashions that they start to follow. Now, I'm just going to have a look at three examples in the next few minutes. First of all, we'll go to Egypt, and then we'll go to Germania, and then we're going to have a look at Palmyra in the desert in Syria. Now, most people that have watched the Discovery Channel or been into the British Museum have seen traditional Egyptian funerary carving images, like this pharaoh with its idealised features. Now, although Egypt had centuries of tradition in funerary ritual and commemoration, when Egypt became part of the Roman Empire, the styles of funerary portraiture changed so that the practice of representing the individual features of the dead in a realistic way, like in Rome, really began to take off. Now, this is one of the earliest images that we have. You can see already that she's got individualized features. She doesn't look like this guy here. It's not all kind of smoothed out. There's actually attention to kind of the fact that her brows meet in the middle, the length of her nose. She's not just a kind of idealized image. She's also absolutely dripping in jewellery. You can see the necklace there. She's got snake bracelets on both wrists. It's a bit damaged on this side and this side. And great big gold earrings. And this is actually, the image is painted in wax mixed with pigment. And then this gold jewellery is actually applied in gold leaf. So this tells us something about how much money people were actually prepared to invest in their funerary portrait. And this is actually painted onto linen, which was then used as a shroud on top of the face of the dead woman. Now, so far this looks quite different to the kind of images that we've seen in Rome of ex-slaves and emperors, but when we compare her hairstyle to the fashions that were in Rome at the time, particularly Agrippina I and II, we see that it's not. It's actually quite similar. She's got the same curls here and these kind of funny little shoulder locks going on in her portrait. Now, some people have suggested this is accidental. It's a ridiculous suggestion. This is absolutely calculated. It's a bizarre style. It doesn't look like anything that came before. It doesn't look like anything that comes after it. She's consciously choosing to use some elements of Roman culture to make herself look Roman in some ways. Now, and she's not alone. This lady here, again, we see her, she's got a lot of jewellery, these trident earrings, down to a kind of pearl pin holding her hair in place. So
Again, this one's actually painted in the wax treatment again and put on, not actually on linen shroud, but on a wood base. But here, again, we look at her hairstyle, and she's actually following Flavian Empress, the styles of the women in Rome at that time. There's a few examples there, with these mounds of curls piled up over the top. Now, so far, we can see that this woman's chosen in some senses to make herself look Roman, but the fact is that they're still being placed on mummies. They're still using Roman-style individual features adapted to Egyptian traditions of embalming the dead so they live on in the afterlife. There are actually a wide range of mummy shapes, so people might choose to be individualised with features like this lady up here, but still put on a mummy form, versus this one up here, which looks a lot more like the kind of Tutankhamun-style idealised mummy image. Yet even here, even in this kind of quite idealised image, there's still, I don't know if you can see it, but there she's got the mound of Flavian curls piled up over the top of her head again. It's just been inserted into the Egyptian wig fashion. And this one here is a cheaper fashion that takes off in the Roman period. It was used in this case for a child. It's just a wooden coffin with a shroud, a linen shroud that's just been painted with, again, with the features of the deceased on. But here again we're seeing this Roman fashion for individualization to live on in the afterlife. Now this is one of the few mummies that's actually still been found with the mummy attached to it. Here we see that we could actually take the mummy itself and x-ray it. We did a CAT scan of this mummy to see how closely the resemblance is between the skeleton and the image of the dead person. And this is the reconstruction that an Italian archaeologist put up for us. And here I've actually seen the portrait when he did this. This is based entirely on the bone structure of the dead person. Now, I think it actually looks quite a lot like the portrait, but there are a few important differences. The mummy, the bones of the mummy show that the man was actually aged 30 to 35 years old, and he also has a problem with his left eye, which they haven't gone for at all in this idealised portrait. Now, it tells us that these portraits aren't just about representing the deceased, they're about flattering them. Not many of the mummy portraits show the dead as old people. It used to be thought that this was simply because people die young, and there were only a few examples like this one here, where it showed people who lived into old age, so it was just thought that this reflected life expectancy. However, it often happens that with images like this one, when we've looked at the mummy inside it, we see that although he looks quite old, the mummy that goes with it, he was 80. So there's still a sort of preference for making him look younger than he actually was. Now, this is important for our understanding of what these portraits of the dead represent. They aren't documentary evidence. There are cultural biases at play here. And in some ways, it's the same as the texts. People choose to be represented in ways that flatter them. And all flattery is culturally defined. So this gives us an insight into what this society valued. In Egypt, it seems to include a preference for making people look younger. And they were, a bit like in our own society, a kind of airbrushing of the deceased. This wasn't the case in Rome, where we see the craggy old features represented in portraits quite often. In Egypt, old faces like this are rare, because this element of Roman culture, it hasn't appealed to them at all. They just don't want to adopt it. They have gone, however, for Roman hairstyle fashions, particularly amongst the women. Now this tells us how it's a kind of picking and choosing this hybridisation of culture. When, as it comes together, people are taking what they want and what they don't want from Roman culture. Different choices are made elsewhere. Now, if we look at Germania, this is an area that has absolutely no monumental tradition in representing the dead pre-contact with Rome. It's a difference from just graves in the ground to monuments like this, or this, or this, that are completely kind of Roman in style, or so they seem at first. They use Latin text, which tells us something about how far this language has been absorbed into the local culture. They also use monument styles like this one, which actually, it looks a lot like the tradition of architecture in North Italy, so a particular Roman form. However, when they actually represent them, it seems that they'll go for things like army soldiers, sort of saying how well they've done in war, how many people they've killed, what regiment they served in. Or this chap here is again in toga, and he's got wife and children who look very much like Roman wives and children. If we were to put these monuments in Rome, nobody would think anything of it. But it's not always as simple as that. So if we look at this apparently North Italian style monument, we see here, this guy isn't wearing a toga, he's wearing something, it looks a little bit like a sack, but it's actually a cloak with hood. That's a particular local phenomenon. He's chosen to do that. Now, it's quite unusual that men choose to go for these styles. Normally they go for Roman army or for toga. But women are often represented in local fashions.
Now, here the woman wears, you can see she's wearing a bodice. That's absolutely not something that would happen in Rome. Women would never look like this.
She's also absolutely, she's got jewellery here, here, here. And so is this lady up here.
Now, these brooches, these necklaces, when we excavate them, when we dig up areas in Germany, they seem to have a regional distribution. So this suggests that actually these fashions reflect perhaps tribal affiliation. Perhaps this woman's kind of reflecting her own traditional indigenous ideas of beauty related to that tribe. The same with this lady up here. The other difference that we see is not only in terms of the dress that people wear, but also in terms of their attitudes towards being represented. Now in Germania, like in Britain, representation, female representation, just doesn't take off on the same scale as it does in, say, Rome or Egypt, where a lot of people would choose to be represented with a portrait. In this area, hardly anybody does. I mean, in Britain, the number of sculpture that we can actually find and relate to images of the dead, it's a handful, it's a few catalogues. This suggests that there's a certain amount of reluctance. Now, that's also confirmed by this image. This lady is called Melimane, which is a Celtic name. And either side of her head, here and here, there's actually deep holes because there seems to have been a metal fastening used to cover the face of the dead, the face of the woman here. Now, this is something that kind of, to us, seems a bit odd. When you look at the inscription, it tells us that the image was put up before the woman had died, and it seems that it's quite likely that she's got the same kind of ambivalence towards seeing herself represented on a funeral stele before she's dead, as say we might if I saw my name in a graveyard with Lucy Audley Miller, born 1977 to dot dot dot. So this woman obviously, like us, seems to feel a bit kind of nervous about it. She's not comfortable with it. Now in Rome, people are completely happy to have their monuments put up before they die, but in this place, it just doesn't take off at all. Palmyra, we've got again a completely different tradition, and this is the last one I want to look at. But again, we've got, as soon as contact with Rome comes into play, people start to represent themselves. People start to buy into this particular tradition of funerary commemoration. They also start to surround the edges of their cities with tombs. You can see up here, this one was taken in a sandstorm, so it's not the greatest picture. But you can see these tower tombs here and here, absolutely encircling the edge of the city, just like in Rome, with slightly different preferences in architecture. Now this is an example of one of the tower tombs that we just looked at. Monuments like this could hold up to 300 bodies, and they put them in here in these morgue-like slabs posted in. The bodies here, like in Egypt, went through a process which was a bit like mummification, but without removal of the organs. If you visit today, you can still see piles of bones actually in the edges, in the bottom of these, they're called loculi, in the bottom of these niches. And some of them still have elements of the fabric actually attached to the bones. In this context, actually, sometimes we even find Chinese silks because they were trading it. However, unlike in Egypt, they're not putting the portrait on the actual mummy. Instead, they put it on here, on the edge of the loculi. Now, in this tomb, unfortunately, the portraits were stolen and sold on the fine art market. But this is the sort of image that they would have used. So we see here this woman, again, looking very youthful and idealised. She's got her head covered, not a wrinkle in sight. Absolutely dripping jewellery, and they've actually painted the jewellery so it shows up more, so you're kind of struck by how rich she is as soon as you go into the tomb. And this one again have covered the end of where she's buried. This one is a Palmyrian priest. We can tell the priest sometimes because they tell us an inscription's there, but usually just because they've got this hat on. That's very distinctive. Only priests in this area wear that type of headgear, and they also shave their heads. So again, this Roman practice of representing the funeral portraiture has been adapted to kind of represent the person in a way that's culturally relevant. Now, these people, these ones and these ones, this is very normal not to show a single sign of age, and it seems to go in the ancient mind together with the practice of burial, so that this kind of preserving of the body of the dead person goes alongside this kind of making emphasising youth, just the same as it does in Egypt. The two seem to go together very well in the ancient mind. This is an exception. He's got these kind of creases and furrows. This is very Roman style. It's just somebody who's kind of embraced that aspect of Roman culture a bit more than the others. We never see it. It's rare that men do it, but we never ever see it for women. It just doesn't happen. Now, this is a subterranean tomb in Palmyra. It's actually underground. And you can see these images here of the dead looking much like ones that we saw before. When the excavators found this monument, it was actually locked. The door was still closed. So that's 1700 years later, they came in and found it almost as it was when it was in use. In this tomb, we've actually got a wells and ovens put there so that when people come along to be with the dead, they can also feast with them. And in front of this Palmyrene priest, you can see that there's a little basin that's been hollowed out. That's so that he can also receive offerings of food and wine. So not only have they adopted it to local fashions, they've also adopted it to local kind of traditions and ways of interacting with images of the dead. So that this man is allowed to kind of participate. He's fed and gets to drink along with the living people who visit him in his tomb. So now finally, just to answer the questions we asked at the beginning, what can funeral portraiture tell us about the lives of people in the Roman world? Well, I'd argue that funeral portraiture shows us that although Roman culture was absorbed through the empire, it was used in different ways in different parts of the Roman world. People took what they wanted from the tradition and used Roman practices to suit local concerns. These images show us that although cultures changed under Rome, they did not become just Roman or stick to what they were in the past. They became something new and different, a kind of hybrid form. Just as we use our bodies and clothes today to shape how people see us and to get across our cultural allegiances, these people use their statues. Funeral portraiture, therefore, tells us about how normal people, like ex-slaves and ordinary people living in the provinces, wanted to be seen. These people have created monuments to themselves, so this is them in their own words, not filtered through the accounts of some Roman historian who views them as barbarians or has prejudices against ex-slaves. This is really, really valuable cultural history, and we can't examine these people in any other way. So that's why I think it's important to look at them. Thank you.